All right, so we might as well get started, then people can filter in as they probably do. So this is the last session, other than lunch, which is normally a session for the conference. So it seems like a good time to once again thank the organizers for bringing us all together and getting us all to think about this week. So thanks to Lucy and to Rob and to everybody in the back of the Lucy perimeter, which is that way to really involved a lot of work. Okay, so the idea here is that we can, in this final session, perhaps catch a glimpse of the future. And so since we don't know how to access these closed timeline curves, we have a bunch of people up here who are going to do lots of interesting research in the future. And so the question that I asked them some rather recently to think about to get our discussion among everybody here going is one research question that occurred to them this week. And by that, I'm a philosopher, so all I mean is a research question is an idea that's worth thinking about more. So I'm going to start with Katja.
I think I've gotten a lot of new ideas and I'm still trying to figure out how they fit together, but one point that's somewhere clear in my mind is relating to the stuff I talked about, because that's the part I know most about, and whether this approach of time delocalized systems could shed some light on how the resonators of space might work and probably relate to the options we're actually interested in.
I don't want to, this is like a discussion with everybody, so somebody else wants to jump in with any others. Or response.
I still don't really know what a time delocalized subsystem is, but I don't know if this is the forum for explaining that.
Can I just
open
them?
It's just a subsystem of a non-local system that they take tensor products of four spaces, take an arbitrary subsystem of that, which is generally localized.
But it can be classical or quantum. I mean, there's not anything.
Yeah, well, classical system is somewhat quite the same concept. You can have unlocalized variables, classical variables.
You know, when you wake up in the morning and you haven't looked at the clock yet, it's Sunday morning, you don't know what time it is. You're a time delocalized system at that point.
So that's. Like,
I just want just to so I can understand what you said, Katja. You're saying you want to understand how time delocalized systems relate to things we are interested in. Is that
The idea is you've got on the one hand sort of real inanimate quantum structure, for example, with superposition of gravitating objects in position time space. Then you've got things like resonators I talked about, which simulate that, and they are in some aspects analogous and some aspects different, obviously. And one question is how different are they, or are they similar enough? And I think that this the framework of time delocalized systems might help me to understand what exactly is happening in the resonators and how it compares to what happens in a real linear causal structure scenario.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
Okay. But I mean, Fabio did say in his talk more or less that, but I always have a feeling that I should emphasize the understanding that the real gravitational switch is from the perspective of a distant observer exactly the same description as the optical switch. So either both are not real implementation or both are real implementation.
So I think one thing for me is making the connection between, I feel like it is nice to manifest structures to describe different causal notions and making connection with like an actual principle as far as like an action might want to
make the cause. So can you speak a bit louder?
How do we go from an action to a process feature?
I see lots of people nodding. Other people would like to know that.
Principle, you know how to do it.
Let's see what we can do about it.
I mean, I have a list of things I'm opposed to, and like brown tea bags, which, you know, because it's ridiculous to cut off the corners of tea bags just to sell them. And I've always felt that the action was something in that category, even though I talked about the action in my talk. I suppose the thing I'm opposed to is that, you know, is that people stop thinking once they've written an action down, and that worries me. And so at least, at the very least, I'd like to see a lot more philosophical work into understanding what the action is and why it's useful in physics. But maybe the project you're proposing would help in that direction rather than
hindrance.
I mean, somehow making it a richer conceptual object rather than just taking it as a starting point where you stop thinking is the way forward.
I think of like Dirac's little book, he says you need to start with an action principle because this is like the easiest way we can implement the symmetry principle. So for me, like the deep thinking sort of comes in deciding what symmetry principles we want to control in the actions.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to make our equations of motion consistent with those principles. But I agree with you that somehow you're right. Once we write down the action, we have a prescription to get equations of motion and we can write usual way. Truncate some of the thinking that's
So just to comment on that, so one could play the game of saying, can we write down some action that then we show corresponds to some process matrix? But you could also turn it on its head and say, well, the process matrix, starting with that, what kind of action might we end up with? And thinking that way would suggest maybe trying to put more physics into process matrices in the sense of, because you mentioned like, you know, the action is a way of kind of capturing statements about conserved quantities. So things like energy and momentum and so on. Maybe if we put those quantities more explicitly into the process matrix formalism, we'd get more intuition about what they physically might represent.
Yeah, no, you're right, actually. I hadn't thought about this, which is totally like flipping it on, flipping the logic the other way around. Like, can you map back to an action principle or something? Maybe an action principle mm-hmm. comes out and you have a specific kind of cognition.
Well, as someone who uses round tea bags,
so do I. There's still.
What's wrong with round tea? Anyway, I just say, like, the reason it's a very good question is the role of the action. But just to expand on what Alex said, if you can make, for example, theories of gravity that don't obey action principles, but they all run afoul of experiment. Very rapidly, you have problems with conservation laws and so on. So I think our bias in favor of an action principle is that it, at least in classical physics, makes sure that things don't go haywire real fast. Now, that doesn't guarantee that this must be true, but I do think it follows the paradigm is that most of quantum physics is we take something classical and we quantize it and that makes it better than it was before. So I think it's good to raise these questions, but I think we should remember why we have this bias in favor of using actions. I suppose I'd add as another comment that one might say the problem with the path integral formulation is the supremacy it gives to an action, that you're integrating over actions. And once Abhay Ashtekar said, path integrals are for people that like to think about quantum physics in a classical way. So, anyway.
Laura.
This could just be because I don't know anything about process matrix formalism, but I want some more physics associated with it. I mean, there are these higher order maps, and you can write, they're linear, they obey certain properties, but what is that really saying? And you've got channels, those are just things you can do to quantum states, and I think I've got a pretty good grasp of what a quantum state is, perhaps I don't, but then what is a process matrix doing to this physical state? What's it saying about anything they're very useful tools, and I've appreciated that, but I don't really know, I don't really know the physics going on there.
Something
yeah.
Simple for state actually, to understand
exactly. Quantum
state.
Oh, sorry.
No, just about the technical connection between action and process matrix. So if you're able to generate an endpoint correlation function, then essentially this endpoint generation correlation function is in it's directly connected with the process matrix. So if you want to describe a process matrix where your laboratory, so to say, are at points in space-time, and this is, in a sense, it's directly mapped with the endpoint correlation functions of quantum field theory. So it's essentially it's mathematically the same. It's just described in terms of density matrices instead of pure states. You have to reinterpret the endpoint correlation function as not being about observables but about cross operators.
Yes.
But modulo that, it's one to one.
So
that's how you map these things.
As I understand, you have one way to compute endpoint functions and that ends. So
if you start from an action, you can calculate endpoint functions, and this gives you the process matrix.
Right. So then, but again, okay. So then, I guess maybe. Okay. So you have two schemes where you can compute endpoint functions. But I mean, I guess more like starting with the when I say action, I'm starting with like a Lagrangian or something. Starting
yeah.
with like a physical theory, and then getting.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You start with your quantum field theory. You calculate endpoint functions. This gives you the process matrix.
No, but what I'm trying to say is that. Like, given a Lagrangian, that's the process. Like, I know you can compute the same thing in two different frameworks, but...
I'm telling you how to calculate the process matrix. So okay, in a field theory scenario, you will not have one process matrix. You will have a family of endpoint process matrices for an arbitrary choice of endpoints of space-time. And that has exactly the same content as the endpoint correlation function of quantum field theory. So that's how you calculate the process matrix from the Lagrangian.
Okay. So then can we not play the game now? Like, given this physical theory, what causal structure does it admit?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
I mean, if you have Minkowski space time, then it's the usual one. Yeah.
All right. Dig, I have you next. Yeah. Go ahead.
Because I was running.
Okay.
So
go ahead now.
Yeah. So it seems that one question is. Difference between the process matrix framework and the action Laplacian framework is that using the Laplacian we can make predictions. We can make predictions on QED process. I think it seems to me what is missing from the process matrix framework is basically predictions. I do this and this in the lab. I mean, it's a different kind of prediction from quantum information. In quantum information processes, we can implement an arbitrary channel. We have too much freedom. This is too general. The concern is that we want some particular deviations, particular numbers running the publications. This is the thing.
Yeah. So the physical predictions are all encoded in the endpoint correlation function. So you can as well encode them in the endpoint.
Put it another way. So what do I miss if I don't use the process matrix?
Well, indefinite causal structures.
What then?
Go ahead.
Good
answer. Well, I have nothing to add. I just wanted to ask, talking about the process matrix formalism, what is the status of it in terms of continuous variables?
Well, again,
so it's normally used to
yeah.
talk about discrete systems.
So
obviously you need to go to continuous variables somewhere.
So again, it's so let's say the process matrix formalism, it's kind of the quantum information. I would say it's the quantum information language to talk about endpoint correlation function. I would put it that way. And so if you go to the quantum field theory continuous variable, then you end up with essentially the same mathematical structure if you have a background space-time. And so then it's equally ill-defined as ordinary quantum field theory, well or ill-defined. So you will have the same technical problems as with continuous variables, non-separable Hilbert space, and so on. But apart from that, there isn't any new issue. The new issues might arise if you want to generalize to indefinite causal structure. That might not be completely obvious.
Well, I guess that's what I mean. Is it possible to go to indefinite causal structures?
So maybe from
you.
Yeah, for me, okay. So, we actually have a generalization to continuous variables of the
yeah.
process matrix formalism. So this is not a field theory picture, it's simplest quantization. So it's S and P. But you can basically, I mean, there are some technical details, but you can basically take the whole formalism process matrices and bring it as it is to the continuous variables. And the type of indefinite causal structures that define is precisely the same as the definition.
Okay, because I don't think I understand what the equivalent of a PCTC is in continuous variables. So, of the indefinite, that whatever the loops are made of in the indefinite causal structure.
Well,
anyway,
you have the same type of allowed terms in process matrices,
and you don't get. Abilities happening.
Well, you do. That's right. So this is the technical difficulty that you have in generalizing the formalism to continuous variables. But they can be cured because in the end, the only thing that you care about is that the probabilities are between 0 and 1, and so basically you can redefine the process matrix part and the measurement part in such a way that the divergences don't occur.
Okay. You have a paper about this?
Yeah. Christina.
Right. So during this conference, the one thing I liked a lot is our discussion about time. I think it's important that we say what we think and maybe agree at some point about it. Another important idea that I always take in conferences is that it's worth thinking about. So this is, it's not about physics, this is about collaborating, and it's about, so I see many times that people have done the same thing, but in a different language, and this doesn't really advance science, and or just collaborating, and so that something, you know, bring different things together, and this, so, I don't know, for me, it's good to evaluate every 5 or 10 years, to see all the work that has been done in some field and evaluate whether we have advanced because the science, whether we have made a step forward. Instead of each one of us, you know, I know that we have grants and we have to study about particular things so that they fit the guidelines that we initially promised. And we sort of tend sometimes to focus on our own line of research and stay on that path. So every time in the conference, that's what I'm thinking, that we should talk to each other more and have this criteria that we need to advance science.
Problem is, it's hard to know if you're advancing science
yeah.
at the time. It's only easier to know in hindsight, you know, once
yes.
you see if it worked out or not.
One question is, funding. If you can get some funding by doing some work, then as much that's an advancement.
The question is which way the causal.
It doesn't necessarily have to be with scientific advancement.
I guess I've been thinking about something similar, and it seems like if you're being very pragmatic in an unphilosophical way, when you have the sort of problem you have with quantum gravity, where we need to figure out a big new conceptual set of issues, it seems for practical purposes the best way to do that is have a bunch of different methodological approaches. And so I've been interested in trying to notice that there's a lot of different methodological approaches that have been taken this week. It's interesting to think about how they relate to each other, but this relates to your comment about making sure people talk to each other, especially people who are starting from quite different starting points and different ideas about what the right methodology is. I mean, there's no one right methodology for science, but thinking about how people can meet, starting from different methodological.
Yes. So one step is to talk to each other, which is what we do in the conference, but often you see that everyone presents their own framework and then they go off to their own respective universities and work on that their own framework, even though sometimes it's exactly the same.
Yeah, so actually one of the things that I found interesting, so in this conference we had
We talked about indefinite causality from a wave flotation theory point of view. We talked about indefinite causality from in terms of quantum of the absence of classical space time, so in which way this is related to gravity. And we also talked about the role of the observer. And these are three things that we treated kind of separately. And some goals we're trying to put two of them together. And I think that now it would be nice to try to find a bit more the relation between these ideas and how they interact with each other. Like, so is indefinite causality something we can talk about? So like in the optical implementation, we want to switch even without. So this seems to be not related to gravity. Is there a fundamental difference instead when we have gravity, which comes into play, or is it actually precisely the same notion?
Laura. Perhaps one way of facilitating these sort of collaborations is when we have these conferences where we bring up a bunch of different people who are approaching sort of the same principle, the same idea, but in very different ways from very different backgrounds, is to perhaps put more focus on giving pedagogical talks. So, I mean, it's one thing to see someone's research when it's a part of a very technical framework and there just isn't time to get into that framework. And maybe have a bit more focus on talks describing that framework and explaining it to the audience. That will allow us to speak a bit more of the same language.
Thomas.
Yeah, I agree with that. I just wanted to highlight maybe like more even pessimistic point. So, people have their own frameworks, kind of doing similar stuff and don't interact. But presumably if you kind of rediscover something, they might email you. But also we need to consider like, you know, people in the past, right, who weren't emailed you just rediscovered. So kind of tension for me is like, it's kind of impossible to keep up to date with everything that everyone's doing currently, plus in the past. And yes, I think that's another kind of difficulty about. Are we just using new frameworks to rediscover the same things? And yeah, it's kind of, I'm not sure how to resolve this tension between doing research and knowing other research, right? Especially difficult if it's like papers from the 60s and 70s in other frameworks.
I mean, I think as researchers, there is a problem that connects to what Thomas just said of, you know, you're affected by the stuff that's in your brain, you know, If you decide I'm going to solve the problem of quantum gravity, so yeah, well let's study everything that's being done on quantum gravity, you know, string theory, quantum gravity, blah blah blah. And you say, okay, I've finished studying everything. Now I'm going to start doing research. Well, then you're just going to reproduce the stuff that people have done, and that's not good because the problem hasn't been solved by those people. On the other hand, you can ignore that work, and then you run the risk of just reinventing stuff that's been done. So I think it's a delicate balance. And the same is true just talking to people generally. On the one hand, you have to spend time either by yourself or in small groups, sort of just trying to make progress. And on the other hand, it's good to have occasions where everyone talks and there's a lot of exchange of ideas. And I think you need both processes in science. I mean, one way to interact with people is to come to Pro-Choice Institute. The corollary of that is that one way to get research done sometimes is to go and hide, like I do, in a cafe somewhere not too far away. And I think that's it's a balance. There's a sort of balance in it for us in that respect.
Well, I was quite sympathetic to what Christina said about doing the same thing in different languages doesn't really advance science. And I often feel in certain subfields, that's a lot of what happens. Let's go back to the beginning and reformulate. And I don't want to say such work is totally valueless, but on the other hand, I do have your question. But I actually wanted to put Doreen on the spot in that context, since what would you say progress, has there been genuine progress in quantum gravity in your career lifetime?
Gosh.
In your opinion, because you know enough about the field, I think, to assess it.
Actually, that's going to be my answer, is I don't know enough about the field to assess it. So let me think in, like, broadly historical context, right? If it's a problem to go back to the 60s and 70s, like if you're going back to Aristotle, like good luck with that. There's just so much history of physics, philosophical ideas, different methodologies and whatever. But one thing I've been thinking about lately is the whole several centuries of developments that happened after Newton published Principia, right? And so everybody knows that what you read in your classical mechanics up-to-date textbooks today looks nothing like what you can see in Principia. And so part of the story is that to get to Lagrangian and Hamiltonian versions of classical mechanics, there was a lot of math that was needed. There was a lot of physics, experimental developments, but also new concepts were added. So it wasn't just a matter of going and making it more general or something. There was a lot that went into that development. So I thought more about relativistic quantum field theory. So my own thinking is, it's unfortunate that since the beginning of relativistic quantum field theory, we've known that we want to get to quantum gravity, right? So special relativity plus quantum theory, putting those two things together, we know it's not enough. So I wonder whether we're not done with that project yet, right? So that's not answering the question you actually asked, but that's a certain way of thinking about what the different approaches are. And that's going to be one of the two. So the point is that it can take a long time for developments to happen, and sometimes going through and looking at the same thing again from different angles and generalizing and
So can I push back on that? Because we hear it takes a long time, but it's often compared to physics of 100 and more years ago, when the number of people doing science was two orders of magnitude less than now. So shouldn't we multiply by the number of people that do the work? Or are we all really just two orders of magnitude stupider than all the other people used to do it? You see, and I would contend that I would make a conjecture that science went through an easy phase in many ways where it was easy. I mean, not that it was really easy, but once you've made some discoveries, that we now know enough that the hard problems are really, really hard. And for quantum gravity, we've had the largest army of people in the history of science by two orders of magnitude at least working on the problem, still isn't solved. And now, I mean, that doesn't mean we shouldn't work on it, but, you know, it's like human labor. It took a long time to build the first bridge, but give me 1,000 workers and you can build a whole bridge a whole lot faster than with 10, right? Isn't that a reasonable thing to have added into the
historic? If you know how to build bridges.
Pardon me?
If you know how to build bridges. It's just to explain this.
Well, we do partly know how to build. If we didn't know how, we wouldn't be here at all. So I would contend we do know something. We don't know the answer to the problem, but we certainly have knowledge of methods more than anybody as a community has ever had.
We might know our bridges.
Well, that's my point. We evidently don't perhaps quite know what the bridge is to build. But it's not A, for lack of trust. But I'm wondering, I think it's fair to add in human labor into the discussion, which
sure,
never
yeah.
seems to
and
happen.
And I think there's no metric you're looking for here, right? Or no, like, standard time increment between major discoveries that you would, like, somehow have a multiplier of the number of people working on. I don't know, what's that kind of thing?
No.
The Higgs would never have been discovered in a basement lab, but we discovered it simply by putting more humans to work.
Dean, did you get to say your idea? I lost track of what happened. So want to make sure you get to say your idea for. So what do you think an interesting research question that came up this week has been?
Okay, this I prepared. Hardy is my supervisor, and is a person. A person who writes, and is one of the person who writes reference letter for me. So during this week, I thought the most interesting idea about from the talk is I think Lucien's idea.
You'll get a better letter, though.
But I'm not serious, so it's really for. I think it's what I like is that he's taking. The gravitational degrees of freedom series, and these are degrees of freedom, a metric or whatever you use, these are degrees of freedom that Arfrid, and if we want to know more about these rhythms, we need to find laws of them. And we can offer some idea of how to proceed. Set up different manifolds and having identification factors and using quantum equivalence principle as a principle, as a starting point to generate new ideas. And I think that you, I'm hopeful that some of us, Bowser, find ways to make actual use of it to understand quantum energy.
So can I ask for a clarification a bit, as since we're thinking a bit about like comparing different methodological approaches, you're emphasizing taking the gravitational degrees of freedom seriously. But one question I have about that is like, is it, do you have a definite idea what you mean by gravitational degrees of freedom? And can you contrast it with, let's say, an approach that you would say doesn't take them seriously?
I think Einstein himself made a transition. He used to believe in mass principle, in one version, which is all the gravitational degrees of freedom are determined by matter. Then he had a debate with De Sitter, who showed him, you know, you have vacuum solutions, you have flat space-time, you have the circular space-time. These are different physical solutions, but you can't distinguish them from matter to freedom. So then you have to take gravitational degrees seriously.
Right, so they're not, so by take them seriously, you mean consider them, let's say, as a starting point and not something that is supposed to be derived from something more fundamental like matter.
It could be derived from something more fundamental, but these degrees of freedom. Well, I would propose that there are laws for them. We should try to discover laws.
I just had a point going back to the whole progress issue. I think we're probably all optimists in this room because it's a very hard problem, you know, which we think we can solve. But yeah, it does seem that the scaling between progress of science and number of humans needing to work on it isn't very favourable. So it's entirely plausible that this will be just a problem, you know, it'll be completely out of reach of, you know, our ways of reasoning and our kind of limitations. Yeah, just as an example, there's this kind of story where, you know, you get AI and now get all the AI, they're discovering new science. But all the humans do is they need to somehow translate the output of this AI to like human readable language. So kind of it's possible that, you know, all these frameworks are kind of limited, and even if there is a framework, you know, even if the book of nature is written in mathematics, it might not be mathematics which is comprehensible to us. So I'm not saying optimism is good, but this is a possibility, right?
So just also want to comment on the same. So you mentioned that several hundred people work on discovery of Higgs. But the original idea of the Higgs party came from few individuals. And when you read some of the interviews Higgs gave after receiving the Nobel Prize, was that he believes that in current academic atmosphere, he would not be able to make this discovery. He would not be able even to get a position. So I guess that the part of the problem is that basically majority of the vast number of researchers in physics are not doing any fundamental research. Prevalent atmosphere is shut up and calculated still. This is a perimeter, is just singularity here. And there is maybe a few more in the world. So the problem is hard, but I'm not sure that many people are really concerned with the problem of quantum gravity or whatever the right now at the border between unknown and known.
Just a quick comment. I mean, the primary reason why there's so many physicists working in physics is that they're being paid. There's a lot of money in physics after the explosion of the atomic bomb. People realize it's worth financing. But before that, people doing physics were psychopaths who were basically doing that, and they couldn't do anything else, and not because they were paid, because nobody really treated science seriously. Nobody paid them seriously. They were willing to commit suicide if their research didn't go well, like Boltzmann or others. So this was a different attitude. For most physicists, it's just a work. It's like it's not something that is like primary reason for existence. It's like a profession. So that also changes the effectiveness of that work.
But also, even if you have people who are working in a very similar situation who are, shall we say, vitally committed to their research, I think there's Another reason why you shouldn't expect to get 100 times the output if you take 100 times as many people is that probably the communication won't be as effective. You'll probably get pockets of people doing the exact same thing, basically. So,
yes, one example on this. So a few years ago, I read on some platform called For Mathematicians was created, and within just a few months. So it was basically something, I don't know, something like they could post some questions, some proof this, some, and then they collaborate, and then they would share their tiny little results towards a big problem. And within a few months, they solved some very, very hard open problems that they couldn't be solved for decades. And they solved that because they, a vast amount of people collaborated on this online platform. So amazing things can happen when we increase the amount of collaboration.
So,
well, I think a lot of people want to talk, which I think is a sign that we should go to lunch and continue this.